I will be presenting here results which come from the paper published by myself, Wojciech Kamiński, and Marcin Zdrowski. We are all from Warsaw University. The goal of, my goal of doing this work was to view spinform, written spinform models from point of view of quantum gravity. So technically this is about generalization of the most recent EPRL model, adapting this model to the language of quantum gravity. Why? There is certain incompatibility between, I say on the transparency that we like to improve the compatibility between loop quantum gravity and spinform models. So the problem is that loop quantum gravity is a full theory with full local degrees of freedom. This is theory of connections, the geomorphism invariant theory of connections. Discretization comes with a certain choice of variables in this theory. However, it's not discretization in the sense of approximation. It's just certain discrete character, operator, spectra, and this is a quantum effect. On the other hand, spinform models are usually considered in environment of piecewise linear spaces, and moreover, in environment of simplicial complex. So actually, I'm not the first person who notices this discrepancy. There are papers in the literature in which people modify quantum gravity to be formulated in piecewise linear space. So I want to go in opposite direction. I want to start with quantum gravity and see what can be or cannot be adapted from spinform models to full loop quantum gravity. Okay, so the strategy. Now, I want to double check that I'm connected. So, can anybody say anything?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, fine. So, my strategy is to start. Yes?
This is Carlo. Again, we don't have a very good system. If you speak louder and closer to the microphone, it's better for us.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm speaking very closely to microphone. Is it better now? Or? Okay, so we start with the EPRL construction, and we just go on and try to see whether we achieve any major fail. So we consider spinforms more general than just simplicial spinforms. There are such spinforms, so yes means that there are such spinforms. Next, we make sure that we understand the structure of the spinforms.
Hello?
Hi?
We don't hear you very well here in perimeter. There seems to be a problem with your microphone. Can you hear me well?
I can hear you very well.
Okay. So can you maybe, as Carlo is saying, try to speak, I don't know, in the microphone very carefully?
So I have the microphone just next to my lip.
Okay. There is some distortion for us. Okay, we'll try to follow anyway.
Is there anybody who can hear me? Hello.
Johannes, we can hear you very well in Potsdam.
Okay. Can you hear you very well at what?
Okay, so let me go on. So there is characterization of vertex in more general spin form, which is suitable for EPRL model. Vertex amplitude is well defined, and also the scheme of the spinform models of gravity. So the scheme, which is the scheme of the EPRL model and potentially other improved models, is also so. The scheme of spinform models of gravity is also can be formulated in quite smooth way. There exists a Barrett-Crane vertex for more general spinforms, as well as the EPRL vertex. So the answer is yes to all those main questions, which is positive. We can go on and do EPRL model in framework of full diffeomorphism covariance of quantum gravity. Since I already showed those results in my previous talks this summer, and some of you could listen to them, I also include some more recent technical results. Namely, we proved injectivity of the map defined by EPRL, which is map which maps SU2 invariants into SU2 times SU2 invariants, but those special invariants which solve the simplicity, the EPRL simplicity constraint. At the end, if there is some time left, I will discuss the limits. So EPRL model depends on extra parameter, which is Barbera-Lindsey parameter, and it's interesting to spell out what it is in when this parameter takes some values which are maybe not naturally allowed in the EPRL model. Okay, let's move to transparency number 3. The title of transparency is papers. So here I just listed those papers which were important for me. So I'm sorry if I missed some papers which are maybe even more important. But certainly the paper which is very important for everybody is the one by Reisenberger and later Reisenberger Rovelli. These were pioneering works on spin pumps. This paper by Barrett Crane, Yetter, Barrett, and Reisenberger, all in 98, they are relevant for generalization of the Barrett Crane intertwider to n-valent vertices. The paper I learned spin pumps from is the paper by Barrett, and also the review by Alejandro Perez, which actually is most loopy. So Alejandro also tries to view spin pump theory from the point of view of loop quantum gravity. Next, the newer series of papers come. Some of them are also classic, so but they are just newer. So there is those works in which Bianchi, Modesto, Rovelli, Speciale, and later Alessi, Rovelli study the propagator of gravitational field, and they discover that Barrett-Crane model should be modified. And finally, they propose their modification in this paper, which I refer to as EPRL because it's easier to remember, but in fact, it is Engel, Living, Pereira, Rovelli. There is also this famous paper by Friedel and Krasnov. I'm sorry that I'm not considering this paper here, but I just focus on EPRL, but this paper also contains some results which are partially overlap, partially are different, but probably are also very interesting to study. And there is also the recent paper which we uploaded in the archives on this, which contains a big part of this talk. Concluding, I want to say that there is still a big potential in Reisenberger's papers. So I think there is a lot of stuff which maybe I'm rediscovering, or maybe some other stuff which even I'm not rediscovering, which is still there. And I really encourage everybody to take a look at his papers written in 1998. There is a lot of stuff there. Let us move to transparency number 4. The title is Diffeomorphism Invariant Theories of Connection. So I would like to specify my departure point. I'm not going to be using this framework later in this talk, but just to make it spell out what I have in mind by talking about loop quantum gravity. So loop quantum gravity is a certain framework of quantization of a diffeomorphism invariant theory of connection. This theory is defined on a manifold. So here I'm talking about three-dimensional manifold. It can be n-dimensional, but let us focus on three-dimensional manifold with some Lie group G. And this Lie group has Lie algebra. And the set of connections, which here we choose a trivial bundle, so the set of connections is just the set of G-valued differential one-form. The key role in this framework is played by parallel transport. So parallel transport is defined by a connection along a finite curve E in sigma. So given a finite curve, given a connection, we calculate the parallel transport. For physicists, the most common formula is first order exponent. Otherwise, we can just write differential equation of parallel transport, and this will be a unique solution defined by initial data. Now, why we need this parallel transport? So we consider functions on the space of connections, which are not completely arbitrary. Namely, we consider those functions which are which depend only on parallel transport. So every function, which we call cylindrical function, is defined by some finite set of oriented curves, and the value this function takes at every connection is a function of parallel transport of this connection along the curves E1, EN. This space admits the action of diffeomorphism. This is also an algebra. It has nice algebra structure. Moreover, there is a very natural diffeomorphic invariant integral in this algebra. And this integral is used to define the scalar product. And with this scalar product, the space of the cylindrical function becomes a Hilbert space. And this is the Hilbert space which is used in quantum gravity as the kinematical Hilbert. Now, in case of loop quantum gravity, this original loop quantum gravity in four dimensions, the gauge group is SU2. On the other hand, if we do spin pump, then originally we have to start with some gauge group SU2 times SU2, which is the Euclidean version of the Lorentz group. On the other hand, this group becomes reduced to SU2 when we imply the simplicity constraint. Now, the cylindrical functions can be constructed from spin networks. So in other words, given spin network, but not abstract, but some embedded spin network, we can always construct from this data cylindrical functions, and cylindrical functions of this form actually span the space of all the cylindrical functions, and one can choose an orthonormal basis out of those functions. That's why spin networks are so often identified with loop quantum gravity. However, originally those spin networks are embedded in this manifold sigma and define the spin network state. Okay, so this was the outline of this diffeomorphism invariant framework of loop quantum gravity. Let us move to page number 5, to the slide entitled the spin network sketch. Okay, so here is just a simple example of spin network, which gives you an idea what spin network is. So consider a graph embedded in sigma. The edges of this graph are E1, E2, E3. And to every edge, we associate an irreducible representation of a group G, and in some Hilbert space, whereas to the vertices we assign intertwiners, which means invariants of the tensor product of those representations. Depending on whether of the orientation of edge, we either take rho or rho star of the dual. In the case of SU2, those representations are equivalent. Now, with this data, we define a cylindrical function which, given a connection A, is constructed in this way that we take the parallel transport of A along each of the edges. Then the representation turns those parallel transports into matrices. And finally, the intertwiners are used to contract the indices of the matrices, and we obtain a number. And this number is a function of a connection. And so, well, it depends on location of the spin network in space. It also depends on A. There is a single number we can extract. Namely, we can always take connection for connection A, the zero connection, and then this cylindrical function is just the contraction of the invariant. So, and this is what is often identified with the spin network by people who do spin network evaluation of some graphs. So this shows this difference. For us, spin network state is not just this number which spin network takes at zero. It's the whole a function on the space of connection. Okay, so this is the spin network state, and the spin form theory is supposed to be theory of evolutions, of histories of spin networks like this one. So let us move to next transparency, the idea of spin network state evolution. So this idea is just that, so let us, well, you can see the pictures, so the pictures tell you more than I, but let me explain what are those black curves. So those black curves, which you can see on the left picture, are world lines of the vertices of the green spin, the green graph, which is on the bottom. So as long as this line is topologically just equivalent to interval, then nothing interesting happens. On the other hand, if this line splits into three other lines, then it means that this history has a vertex and something interesting is going on. So in those histories, the vertices become curves, so we call them edges, but now they are edges of spin forms rather than spin networks. And edges meet at vertices, but those vertices are spin form vertices. Edges themselves become two-dimensional faces, which here on this picture on the left-hand side, every face is marked by blue circle with blue-oriented circle, but not really full circle. So wherever you see this blue circle, it means that there is some world sheet of an edge. And on the right hand, on the right picture, there is depicted initial spin network and the final spin network. So this is just the idea, because here are the only graphs, we need to fill it with labeling. So this was the original idea by Rovelli and Greisenberger, and it is now developed by them and by in form of the existing spin network, spin form model. Okay, so let us move to next transparency and let us see more detail. So next transparency is number 7, is entitled Foam Element. So the elements of foam are two-dimensional elements, which we call faces. Blue circle marks the orientation. One-dimensional elements, they are called edges, and they're also oriented. And zero-dimensional elements, which are called vertices. And there's nothing more I can say about those. So these three elements, by suitable gluing, which is presented at the next transparency, called foam gluing. So they are they are glued together and they form a foam. Mathematically, I think that the most appropriate set of foams are linear two-cell complexes with boundary or bounded by spin networks. I'm not 100% sure that we cannot go to general CW complexes, but there was always this question in physics whether or not it is good for anything. But if it were good for anything, we could try to generalize spin forms more and see how we can adopt all the CW complexes. For the time being, we think of linear two-cell complexes, or at least complexes which locally are linear two-cell complexes. Okay, so this is as much as we need to know about the foam itself, but now the labeling by extra stuff is coming. So we move to transparency number 9. Spin foam is made by suitable coloring. So faces are colored by irreducible representations of the given gauge group. Edges are colored by intertwiners between representations of faces which share a given edge. And here there is some technical detail, but it at least for me, I found it very useful that I associate to an edge actually a pair of intertwiners. An intertwiner to the beginning of an edge, and the Hermitian adjoint of this intertwiner to the end of an edge. And I find it useful to not to make any mistake when I next connect those elements. Okay, so then let's move to the next slide, number 10, entitled Spin Network Induced on the Boundary. So to talk about, to think of spin networks as histories of spin forms as histories of spin networks, we have to consider bounded spin forms. Again, I refer everybody to the definition in Baez's paper of 2000. You can also find the definition of bounded two-cell complex in any book on linear two-cell complexes. So this picture on the left-hand side, it shows a spin form bounded by on the bottom by the green one complex, or graph if you want. It's obvious that the labeling of spin form induces some labeling on this bounding graph, which makes this graph a spin network, which is separately depicted on picture B on the right hand. So this is the relation between spin forms and spin networks. The spin networks leave the spin networks bound spin. Okay, as we know, this is, there is nothing revolutionary in this. This is the usual approach. Let us go on to transparency number 11, about faces meeting at a vertex. So a characterization of vertex is actually the key element of spin form. So what is a vertex? The vertex is a meeting point of several edges. Each edge, spin form edges, each edge comes with an intertwiner. And now you can see that each edge either contributes the Hermitian adjoint of its intertwiner or the intertwiner itself, depending on whether it ends at the vertex or whether it has the beginning point at the vertex. Okay, but in fact, to understand the structure of this vertex, we need to know in what way the edges are coupled with the faces. So we remember that every edge is contained in some face, and actually every face contains two edges which meet at this vertex. So on this picture B, I added information about the faces. So every blue oriented circle, marks one of the faces which connect to given pair of edges. Okay, so this is the vertex. The vertex of a spin form. And now the question is how to characterize this vertex in complete way. What information is needed if it was the other way around than it is in reality? So if you could only hear my voice and if you couldn't see the pictures, so then I would tell you, let us go to next transparency, number 12, the vertex structure. So then I would tell you the following. Take the vertex and its close neighborhood. What is neighborhood of a vertex is clear because a vertex is an element for every face, a vertex is a point on a plane which is defined by this face, so it's clear what is the neighborhood. So we take the collection of those neighborhoods and we can imagine that we have scissor and those green lines, they show how we cut this neighborhood from the spin form. So now if we throw away the rest of the spin form, we are left with this part of spin form which is the neighborhood of the vertex. And this is a spin form with boundary. Those green curves become boundary of this bounded spin form. And we can use our definition of spin network induced on this boundary. So let this spin network be called, the corresponding spin network be called psi. And now we can throw away the spin form and just we can be left with this spin network, the green spin network on picture B. So now I'm telling you that this spin network contains all the information about this vertex. Moreover, we can also calculate a number. We can evaluate the spin network at zero. And if we take its complex conjugate, then this is what is usually defined as a vertex amplitude. Okay, so we can do the most basic, we can define the basic tools of spin forms. We can define vertices, we can define vertex amplitude, and this is what we need to do spin form models. Let us move to next transparency number 13. Consists of vertices which are glued together along some edges, and of kind of trivial spin foams which contain no or trivial segments of spin foams which contain no vertex. So here is an example of a spin foam which is just static evolution, nothing changes. The only thing we should, very technical point we should be aware of, that if you look on the right hand or right on the picture on the right hand side, you can see that the spin network on the top is actually kind of inverted spin network on the bottom. I call it complex conjugate because the corresponding function is just complex conjugation of this original function. On the other hand, we know that it should be the same. So it means that we always have to take this spin network on the bottom and take its complex conjugate. Or in other words, that we have to consider the spin network on the bottom as cat and spin network on the top as bra. Then it agrees with our with what we are used to in quantum mechanics. Okay. So the conclusion is that every spin foam can be constructed from those two elements, from vertices and from trivial or say static spin foams like this. Okay, that's why I've been talking only about a kind of abstract spin foam. But now let us go back to quantum gravity. Let us go back to spin foam models. We want to characterize gravity, and so to describe gravity by spin foam model. So what we need to do is we need to go to transparency number 14, which is entitled the scheme of Euclidean spin foam model. Okay, so the gauge group is for Euclidean spin foam model is SU2 cross SU2. The kinematical Hilbert space is spanned by the spin network states, which are defined by spin networks embedded in a given three-manifold sigma. So this is the same Hilbert space as the space of kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity, except for the difference that we take SU2 cross SU2. So it's a little bigger than in the usual canonical frame. But maybe because it comes from this covariant framework. Now, histories of spin network states are embedded spin foams in sigma cross R. So here comes a small difference as compared to, of my point of view, as compared to the usual point of view, that I tend to consider embedded spin foams rather than abstract spin foams. And those embedded spin foams evolve embedded spin networks. Okay, and next device is the spin foam amplitude. So the spin foam amplitude is defined by using the a vertex amplitude, by using the dimension of representation assigned to internal to faces. And there is some extra, we have to do extra adjustment in case if we have some on the boundary, we have some vertices, some intertwiners which are not normalized to one. So then perhaps we have to introduce extra factor. Otherwise, we don't have to worry. We can just normalize the intertwiners to be one, and then this extra factor disappears. Okay, but gravity consists in imposing the simplicity constraint on the intertwine. Okay, and as we know from the history of spin foam models, those simplicity constraints are not really uniquely defined. So Barrett Crane came up with one definition of the simplicity constraints, and the solution of the simplicity constraints is known as Barrett Crane intertwiner. Another proposal, which seems to be the closest to general relativity we know, is the EPRL intertwiner. So it is a solution to EPRL simplicity constraint. So in any case, the idea is that we restrict, given any vertex, an n-valent vertex, we restrict the Hilbert space of all possible intertwiners to some subspace, which solves the constraint. And then we use only the subspace in summing the spin foam amplitude. So in each subspace, we choose an orthonormal basis, and we allow labeling by those simple means, solving the simplicity constraint intertwiners, which come from this orthonormal base. And this I would consider a quite good outline of the structure of Euclidean spinform model. Now details are in how we apply it and which simplicity constraint we use, whether we use Barrett Crane or whether we decide to use ETRL in FitFinder, whether we perhaps come up with some yet another idea. Okay, so this is the outline of the scheme of Euclidean spinform model. So as you can see, there is nothing which would prevent us for thinking of this, for applying this scheme to arbitrary spin networks, not only simplicial. And actually, we don't have to invoke the piecewise linear spaces at all. We can start with our spin networks, and we can consider all those spin network histories which are provided by most general linear two-cell complexes. Those two-cell complexes, I still call them linear, but it is only a topological characterization. So they can be tangent, so faces of those spin forms can be tangent to each other, but this being tangent is a property of embedding. But otherwise, they are I think the sufficient set are those linear spin forms. Okay, so let us move to transparency number 15, which contains more details about the intertwiners, which are on the market. So let us start with Barrett-Crane intertwiner, because anyway, this ETRL intertwiner is actually not. So it's good to learn this Barrett-Crane intertwiner to quicker understand the ETRL intertwiner. So the Barrett-Crane intertwiner is defined in the suitable space of invariants. Those invariants are invariants of representations of SU2 cross SU2. So representation of SU2 cross SU2 is a pair of SU2 representations. Okay, and the space of intertwiners of tensor product of n pairs of SU2 representations is the tensor product of the invariants of the first n representations, J1 plus times, etc., JN plus, times the space of invariants of J1 minus times, etc., times JN minus. So general intertwiner of SU2 times SU2 is just a tensor the space of intertwiners is spanned by tensor products of pairs of intertwiners. And now, briefly speaking, the Barrett-Crane intertwiner is just the most natural intertwiner, which is the identity map between the invariants of row 1 times etc. times J1 until JN into J1 plus times etc. times JN plus. However, in this case, J1 plus equals J1 minus each JI plus is equal to JI minus. So the Barrett-Crane simplicity constraint is telling us that J plus and J minus are equal to each other, and this Barrett-Crane intertwiner is just the natural identity map between the two SU2 invariant spaces. If you need a more explicit formula, then you can, for instance, choose some, here it's marked by red the color, basis, orthonormal basis in the space of invariants of rho J1 times of the tensor product of rho J representations. And then from those basis, you construct the projection operator by taking tensor products. This is next formula and this red part. So this is sum of tensor products of elements of this basis. However, now the intertwiner of the left-hand side of this formula has all the indices only upper indices. On the other hand, this red projection has part of indices are upper, but part of indices are lower. So we have to find a way to raise those lower indices. So we do it with uniquely defined invariant of hj times hj. So the tensor square of every Hilbert space has, every representation has uniquely defined invariant. So we use this invariant vector to raise those. Okay. Now, what is this Barrett-Crane interfinery good for? Why was it defined as it was? This is, it's good because it satisfies certain identity, which I wrote in next formula in compact way. So this identity means that if I take an operator which acts on indices with classes, then and apply to this Barrett-Crane interfinery. And on the other hand, if I use the same operator and apply it to the indices with minuses, to the other pair, then actually the result is either the same or plus minus the same, provided that this operator O has some symmetry with respect to the epsilon, this invariant two-form or invariant vector or invariant. And in particular, there is a large class of operators which are used to define the area operator. And this area operator can be, should be equivalently written either by action on indices with pluses or by action with indices on indices with minuses. And so those operators denoted by O, the most important class of those operators are the area operators. And they are kind of intertwined by this Barrett-Crane interfinery, which is exactly the simplicity constraint in this case. However, this interfinery seems to overdo the job because it not only intertwines the area operators, but it also intertwines the flux operators. And flux operators, so it looks like it was also coming with some gauge choice. This gauge choice that the surface of initial data is orthogonal to this gauge choice, which corresponds to choosing a shift equal to zero and a frame which is tangent to three elements that tangent to the surface of the initial data. Okay, that's also fine. I'm just only saying that it's not completely covariant approach, that it looks like choosing a gauge orthogonal to the surface of the initial data. And now, I understand that the problem with this Barrett-Crane model was that if we check the number of degrees of freedom, we can see that each intertwiner is identified by the sequence of J. So we give sequence of SU2 representations, J1, J2, Jn, and then either there is a non-zero intertwiner or there is no intertwiner, but there are no more than one modulo rescaling. So it looks like not enough freedom not as much freedom as one would expect. And probably that was why this model was found not to provide a sufficiently big Hilbert space for what we want to do. Okay, so let us move to transparency number 16. So what is the ETRL intertwined? Okay, so again, we are starting with the cross product of SU2 times SU2. Again, a representation is a pair of SU2 representations. And again, our ETRL intertwiner will be element of the invariant space of tensor products of the pairs of representations, labeled by pairs J1 plus and J1 minus, etc., Jn plus, Jn minus. Okay. But now, what are ingredients of this intertwiner? To see what are the ingredients, you have to go to the bottom and start reading this transparency from the bottom. So we need some sequence of SU2 representations labeled by K1, by half integers K1, K2, Kn. Okay. Next, we take an invariant of those representations, which is denoted by iota. Okay. So now we go up. Now, given those K1, K2, Kn, and given some gamma, which is the new Zibarbero parameter. We calculate J1 plus, J1 minus, etc. by this formula for J plus, and J1 minus, J2 minus, etc. from this formula for J minus. So from K and from gamma, we calculate the pair J plus, J minus. And one more ingredient we need, but it's actually already there, is the unique invariant of the Hilbert spaces for every I of the Hilbert spaces of the tensor product of Ji plus, Ji minus, and Ki. And there is unique invariant up to rescaling, and we need this invariant. And from this data, we calculate this EPRL intertwiner, and there is this formula in the middle of the transparency, which is telling us what this intertwiner is. Okay, so you can see the simplicity, the comparison with Barrett-Crane intertwiner. So in the case of the Barrett-Crane intertwiner, so now look at this red projection operator. It has upper indices and lower indices. So those lower indices are now raised by the intertwiner, the invariant C1 and C2, Cn. However, they are raised to a pair. Each B is raised to a pair of indices, A and B. So those B are kind of outstanding indices. So that's why we need this extra SU2 intertwiner to contract those B indices. Okay, so now as we can see, again, EPRL intertwiner is given by some set of some sequence of SU2 intertwiners, of SU2 half integers, K1, K2, Kn. However, now there are given a sequence of half integers, K1, K2, Kn, there are more than one intertwiner. There is actually, from every invariant of those representations, we construct another EPRL intertwiner. Okay. However, on the other hand, it's not obvious from this formula that from two different SU2 intertwiners, we construct two different EPRL intertwiners. So if you want to know what is the range of this map, so how many are those EPRL intertwiners given some n-valent vertex and given n having integers, we have to study this EPRL map, which maps SU2 invariants into SU2 cross SU2 invariant. And if this map is injective, then it means that this dimensions of the Hilbert spaces agree. So this is our technical result, which I wanted to report. So the result is the statement that theorem that for every n-valent vertex, the EPRL map, which maps SU2 intertwiners into EPRL intertwiners, is injective. So now the proof splits into two cases. One case we actually already published in our paper, which is for gamma bigger equal 1. Then the relation between J plus and J minus is that J plus is J minus plus K. And actually, this is the only assumption we used there. We didn't use this explicit formula, which gives J plus and J minus by using the Mirzi parameter. And the key observation was the properties of the composition of the spins. In the case when we compose the spins to the highest possible total spin. So when spins J minus and K are composed to J minus plus K. So this map does not kill simple tensor products. And this is the reason why it doesn't kill the SU2 intertwiners either. And then of the game. Okay. However, we have a yet newer result, which is unpublished, but I know this result from Wojtek Kamiński, my student. So the result is that if we take now gamma from the interval from 0 to 1, then again we have a similar relation, which is J minus plus J plus equals K. But now we need, in fact, also to know this relation that J plus minus is 1/2 times 1 plus minus gamma times K. And using the two relations, now let us move to the next transparency, number 18. What we do is the following. So we take some SU2 intertwiner. So this is invariant of the tensor representation, tensor product of tensor representation, tensor product of SU2 representations, rho k1 times rho k2 times rho kn. Okay. Now what we do is we intertwine the first two k's, k1 and k2, into some total spin k12. And we do this intertwining with the operator denoted in second item by P. So this capital P is operator which intertwines K1 times K2 into K12. Okay? So we apply this operator to our invariant. And we choose the lowest possible K12 such that the result is not zero. Okay? So given this number, K12, actually this is the number which we need, K12. We construct another element of SU2 times SU2 intertwiner space, which will not be orthogonal to the image of our SU2 intertwiner. So since it will be not orthogonal, it means that the image itself will not be zero. So what is this intertwiner we construct? We construct it in this way. But now we take the space of intertwiners SU2 times SU2, so they are labeled by J1 minus, JN minus, and J1 plus, JN plus. And now we intertwine J1 minus and J1 plus into J plus 1, 2, and the same with J1 minus and J2 minus. Once again, we intertwine J1 plus and J2 plus into J1 2 plus and J1 minus and J2 minus into J minus 1 2. However, we look for an element like this which satisfies the extra condition that J minus 1 2 plus J plus 1 2 equals K1 2. So this is actually the condition which EPRL intertwiners satisfy. However, this is kind of weaker condition than EPRL. And then we find that to begin with, first statement, first lemma is that there exists such element, and second lemma is that this element actually, the scalar product of this element with the image of our EPRL map applied to the given in the first line. If you think that finally that this scalar product is not zero. So if it's not zero, then certainly the EPRL map applied to this iota cannot be zero. So in this way, we prove that EPRL map does not kill any non-zero SU2 intertwiner, and that the number of so there are given some n-valent vertex, the dimension of the Hilbert space of EPRL intertwiners. And even if we fix the hub integers k1, k2, kn, is the same as the dimension of the SU2 intertwiners, just of representations k1, k2, kn. Okay, so this completes the question of the number of degrees of freedom in the EPRL intertwiners. And this is the end of the technical part. And the last transparency, number 19, and maybe there's some continuation.
I'm sorry, I lost about conceptual things here. So if you go back to transparency, the EPRL intertwiner, I think it's 16. Okay. So you told us that the invariant R is not unique, right? The little I, which is at the very bottom of the transparency, there are many invariants. We don't have a unique one.
Right.
Right. And so the question is, therefore, if I put in different invariants here, what happens to the left-hand side of the equation in the middle of the transparency? Do I get the same EPRL or not?
No, the point is that different invariants I define different EPRL intertwiners.
Right.
And the main technical result is that this is exactly true.
Okay. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the little i's, which are invariant spaces,
and the PRL in the vertex invariant that it has.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And this was, so the answer is yes, kind of brief answer and vaguely, but also the next two transparencies prove that this answer is in fact exact, so that there is no intertwiner iota, this SU2, which would be killed by this EPRL map, which was on this transparency number 6. Okay, so as I said, this as we all know, simple models, this EPRL simple model, it involves Barbero immunity parameter. So now we can see what happens with this model and with when we go with this parameter to some values which are kind of degenerate values. So to begin with, when gamma takes value plus minus infinity, then the Hall's action just becomes the Palatini action. So from the point of view of the classical theory, this is not the degenerate point, it's just a well-established limit, and it means that we consider the original Palatini action. Then from the EPRL, solution to the constraint becomes J plus equals J minus, K equals zero, and EPRL intertwiner converges to the BC intertwiner. Moreover, this limit, this continuity is also the property of the derivation. So we could rewrite the EPRL paper just starting from the Palatini action, and then we would derive the Barrett-Crane intertwiner. So actually, this is the way Barrett-Crane could also well derive his intertwiner. Okay. So now let us go to another limit. The other limit is the limit that cannot be extended to the entire derivation, although the host action does converge perfectly well to the self-dual action, is the limit of gamma equal plus minus 1. So we know that there is that this value is kind of degenerate for certain algebraic transformations in this between the space of two forms and frames. However, we also know that despite of this degeneracy, if we just use only left-handed or right-handed self-dual two forms, then still this, although it's not completely obvious, this classical action is actually the equivalent to the Einstein gravity. Okay, so we could hope that EPRL will give us a nice treatment of this self-dual approach to gravity. And what is surprising to me is that in this case, the EPRL derivation is not continuous, but the result is continuous. So the limit of the result is that J minus plus equals zero and K equals J plus minus. And moreover, the EPRL map becomes just the identity. So the EPRL intertwiner is just the SU2 intertwiner, and the amplitude becomes the SU2BF amplitude. So it seems that the limit gamma goes to plus minus 1 of the EPRL model, instead of being some model which in some way which is non-trivial and which hopefully can be Euclidean gravity, gravity described by Euclidean Ashtekar variables, is just the SU2BF theory. So I find it strange, but maybe the experts know better why it is the case. And finally, one more limit which you can consider is the limit in which the Hall's action is no longer equivalent to the Palatini action. However, it just becomes, after the rescaling by gamma, it becomes the action of SU2 times SU2BF theory, and this limit is gamma equals zero. So the EPRL model again admits this limit, and then J plus is equal to J minus, K is J plus plus J minus. However, at least I cannot see that this theory resembles the BF SU2 theory. So it doesn't look like BF. For me, it looks like quite non-trivial theory, which may have potentially some degrees of freedom. And this is what I also don't understand. Okay, so in conclusion, apart from those limits which I discussed at the end, I conclude that the EPRL model can be adopted to loop quantum gravity. We can construct histories of states of loop quantum gravity. We know how to calculate amplitudes, how to calculate EPRL intertwiners, and we can apply the scheme of EPRL. Of course, there is still this derivation of EPRL model which uses the simplicial complexes, so I'm not saying that I can see this derivation on this more general level. However, all the results of this derivation are also available when we do this diffeomorphism covariant framework of loop quantum gravity. This is it. Thank you.
Questions? Any questions?
Two questions, which are rather general, I think. The first is that what happens, or what do you know about the Lorentzian signature? And the second is what...
Here there was nothing about the Lorentzian signature.
Yeah. So therefore, what do you know, which is not published, but you already know something, or you see a difficulty, or you don't see a difficulty?
I just don't know. I didn't think too much about the Lorentzian signature in this context.
Okay. And then, can you comment anything about the Prandtl-Krasnov model? I mean, why is it that, is it just, you just happen to look at this one, or there is some difficulties, at least technically, that you see to generalize it to the full LQG with piecewise analytic graphs and so on, or is it that you just happen to look at EPL, EPRL model first?
So the answer is yes to the second alternative. So I just read EPRL in more detail, and I only know that Friedel and Krasnov, that they have some other motivation to define those simplicity constraints, that they start with coherent states, and by looking at the coherent states, they derive what is the set of intertwiners that would be sufficiently big to span those coherent states. And as far as I know, in some range of gamma, their model overlaps. I think in this physical range where gamma is between minus 1 and plus 1. On the other hand, for gamma bigger than 1, which we know from black hole entropy that is unphysical, and then for this range of gamma that Friedel-Krasnov model, as far as I know from them, is inequivalent.
Hello, this is Simone from Marseille.
Hi.
Can make a comment on the discontinuity at gamma equal 1 that you mentioned. This thing is puzzling me also for a long time, and so my point of view on this is the fact that it isn't precisely the old structure that one is quantizing, but it's rather BF plus gamma BF with then some constraints.
Can you repeat for me which limit now you
the gamma equal 1 in which you pointed out the old structure one would expect as dual gravity, whereas in the model one seems to get something that at least from the vertex point of view is just BF theory.
Okay.
You pointed these out, right?
Yes.
And you were puzzling why.
Yes, so this is my point of view number 19.
Mm-hmm. So my point of view on this is the fact that one is not really quantizing the old structure, but rather BF plus gamma B star F with constraints added in the path integral, okay? Which does not correspond straightforwardly to just integrating over the Lagrange multiplier of the constraints of the Plebansky formulation of the old structure. And if you look at the gamma equal 1 case of this way of imposing the constraints, now you don't, in fact, recover self-dual gravity. So it makes sense that you don't get gravity. So it is puzzling at the point of the I think the right way out of the puzzlement is to realize what is the real action the one is starting from. Oh, that was all my comment.
Okay, but if you do it the way you are saying it, right, not using the Blavatsky action, and, but starting the post action and imposing the constraint in the informed way, so to say, then yes. Is it true that the theory you get is the BF theory?
Well, it wasn't quite even BF theory. that part remained a bit puzzling.
Okay.
If I remember, because I would have expected, one of the self-dual to become identically zero and then just BF theory for, let's say, the anti-self-dual or something like this. But it wasn't that clear.
No, it is.
So it is okay. So to Laurent, it was.
Okay. Also, I mean, when you take limits, you have to be careful what you keep fit. So there's many limit gamma infinity or many limit gamma equal 0 or gamma equal 1. It depends if you fix the area or you fix the spin or you fix the... So one always has to be very careful what we mean by a given limit when you have a system. You know, you have to fix certain, when you take the limit, you always have to fix certain other physical quantity, and that's so the limit from the whatever EPRL model that would be self-dual gravity is a very tricky one, because you'd have to rescale the spin at the same time as you take gamma limit going to 1, and it would be very interesting to be able to do that properly.
Yes, I agree with Laurent. Indeed, if I consider some observable, then this observable can also involve gamma, and then I should consider the limit of expectation values of this observable. So maybe this may be a different limit. Thank you. Yes, I agree with this one.
But still, Laura, I think an interesting point for me is that you're saying that there is a consistent way of taking a limit, which on the one hand would give you a BF theory, and on the other hand, in the EPRL model, will also give me an amplitude consistent with the BF theory. That's what you're saying. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. If you take the EPRL model and you just put gamma equal 1 there, there's nothing singular that happens, and you just get this U2BS. That's true. If you don't rescale the spin properly, I mean, if you just, do it naively, that's what you get. And that's something to understand better.
More questions?
Yes, this is John Engel. I have a question. I have a remark. The question was asked, what happens to the FK models? What happens to the intertwiner space? And as far as I understand, if you want to assign some intertwiner space to the FK models, essentially you take a given J plus and J minus that are constrained in a certain way, and then given this J plus and J minus, in the EPRL model, there was a certain relation among J plus, J minus, and K. And if you fix J plus and J minus, then there's actually a range of possible Ks which will also satisfy this relation. And essentially, the FK intertwiner space will be the direct sum of the EPRL intertwiner spaces for all the different Ks. So in the FK model, there will not be an isomorphism between the SU2 intertwiners and the intertwiner space. And instead, you have an additional label K involved. But because the FK intertwiner space is really just this direct sum of EPRL intertwiner spaces, I think what Jersey presented already gives you an understanding of how to view the FK intertwiners from his perspective. I don't know if Laurent would agree with what I said. But
as Jersey was saying, for gamma smaller than 1, there is no discrepancy.
So I'm sorry. Yes, I should have.
For gamma bigger than 1, what you're saying is true. In fact, there are in fact three ways to look at this as how you impose the constraints, two which are published already and one which is maybe going to come out from Florian. But in the case, all these three ways to look at the constraints, they all agree in the gamma smaller than one factor, but they don't agree in the gamma bigger than one factor.
Yes,
now, one could say that we don't really care because in the Lorentzian case, there's no such discrepancy in some way.
Right.
In the Lorentzian case, we are not able to have models, info models, that see the self-dual factor, which would be gamma equal I. So so there's no such two different models.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so I meant to say what I said was for gamma greater than 1.
Yeah.
But is the statement then that for the Lorentzian case, there is nothing special at gamma equals 1, of course, but then the statement is that, in fact, there is agreement between the two models for all the region of gamma, or is the statement that you don't see any reason that there should be disagreement?
There isn't any proposal from Friedel and Krasnov in the Lorentzian case for arbitrary gamma. Because you don't have a good notion of coherent states to do the job for you.
So also for the Lorentzian case, Krasnov-Friedel model is only for gamma less than 1, is that correct?
No, it doesn't exist. It only exists for gamma equals infinity in the Lorentzian case.
Is that right, Laura?
Yeah. There's no there's no proper notion of coherent states. Have been developed yet in the Lorentzian case. So,
although there is one that arises nicely in the semi-classical studies of Barrett, Robert, and the others.
Yeah, but the point is that these
but it's different. Yeah.
Exactly. These coherent states are not labeled by vectors. They're more complicated, so you can't really use them to impose the simplicity constraint.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I have another question. This is Alejandro from Marseille. You talked about the limit where gamma is equal to 0, and you said that this
yes.
is supposed to be BF theory, and I get very confused by that, because the limit of the gamma equal to 0 limit is a topological theory, I agree, but it's a more complicated thing than just BF theory.
Why is it? More complicated.
Well, the gamma equals to zero.
It looks like BF.
It's E which F theory.
Oh, you mean that this is BF here?
It is not exactly BF because there's still the simplicity constraints imposed.
Right.
That's what Alessandro was saying.
Yeah, and that theory is topological. That's true, but it's not something
okay.
that we understand very well at the spin-com level. So. Evaluating this model at gamma equal to zero and getting something that doesn't look simple at first sight doesn't...
Okay, I agree. So you mean that I still introduce some constraints on BF theory? Just those constraints are maybe...
This term that one usually adds to the usual first order action to get the Hall's action.
Right, but this is just this is plus some kind of simplicity constraint. So okay, I agree. It's some theory which probably we don't normally consider. So maybe this is correct limit.
This is Carlo from Marseille. I have a comment here from me.
Hi, Carlo.
Hi. It's a general comment. I wanted to sort of take the discussion away from the limit to your general results that you have presented. I want to say that I find these results very reassuring. There have been a lot of discussion here. I mean, after what you have done, Jerzy, how should one take all this? I mean, should one think about regulations, about diffeomorphic invariants in I+, what is the right framework? Now, myself, when I started working on trying to derive spin networks from triangulations, I thought this was a very useful tool. But on the other hand, I was very worried very much that one was introducing mathematical structure that only made sense with an actual triangulation of space-time, and this sounded very sort of unphysical to me. I mean, the entire construction of spiritual models based on chopping on sort of chopping space-time in regge synthesis. I view it as a tool, not as a fundamental thing. I don't think nobody here thinks that space-time is actually made by small tetrahedra, which you know, sharp corners and precise angles and things like that at the Planck scale. So at the end of the construction, the model looked nice, but on the other hand, was this mathematics sort of, is this mathematics the right one? So what you're showing here is that the tools used to define the theory makes perfectly sense in a much larger setting, and in fact had nothing to do with the triangulation itself. I don't see this as a sign of tension between different ways of viewing the theory. The other way around, I see it as a sign of agreement and convergence between different steps we take in trying to construct the dynamics of the quantum gravity. I mean, we sort of have a nice kinematics. We try to construct the dynamics, and you're showing that the extra ingredient that we used in building the spin forms actually are not tying the theory to structure that we don't think is very physical.
Yes, I absolutely agree. This is also my point of view, that it shows that this ETRL model is more universal and more robust than just simplicial complexes.
I should actually be completely agreeing, and I do agree that, in fact, Eurek's results make everybody very comfortable, and I completely agree with that. But we could also look at it from the other point of view, maybe just as a devil's advocate, namely that these results are telling us that, in fact, restricting yourself to simplicial complexes does not take any essential physics away. Maybe that's not, because we're not worked out all the details or anything like that. But supposing it is the case, then maybe it is a good idea to stick oneself to the simplicial complexes, because, I mean, A, for calculational facilities, but more because kind of it's a minimal framework, right? I mean, like in the canonical theory, just looking at the four-valent vertices, we don't want to go down to three-valent because then the volume would be zero, but looking at just four-valent vertices is kind of the minimal complication you must have. And if, in fact, there are results which say that the minimal complications are not too restrictive, in other words, they can be generalized to a completely general case, then maybe it is good to restrict ourselves to the minimal complication. And, I mean, you can look at the robustness is very, very important, but you can look at it one way or the other, right? I mean, one can say that, well, for practical purposes and calculations and thinking, we might want to restrict ourselves not to the piecewise analytical category, but a simpler category. So I'm just raising this, and maybe people would like to criticize this, because I'm not saying that I believe this strongly, but it's certainly a possible viewpoint.
I would agree with Abai. It depends on the point of view you want to have, but if the point of view is that you want to have a formulation of the dynamic which is consistent, if you manage to do it first only a restrictive subset of graph which contains, you know, enough physical states, which are these four valent ones, that would be just a huge result. So, you know, if you take the point of view of the dynamics, that's very, I don't know, it doesn't look like a very strong restriction to me.
Of course, we did not know this before Eurek's results. I mean, you know, I'm using Eurek's results in order to raise this possibility. Carlo, do you want to say something?
I fully agree. Two comments. One is that since long we have always had this sort of doubts, right? Should we take, for instance, does it make sense to restrict the theory to four valid nodes? This was a question on the table before the spin network. This is independent of the spin network. In fact, at the very beginning, we were asking whether it makes sense to restrict the theory to trivalent nodes, and then we found an answer. The answer is no, it doesn't, definitely doesn't. So these questions are there. Now, I think the questions are important. My own view on those is that to the extent we have a model with which we can calculate, in principle, I mean, I wish I was able to do more physics and work more. What we should do is to what we have to do is to try to compute exact numbers of the theory and see what happens with one alternative and the other. This is what I would like to be able to do. I mean, it's do a more complicated state play a role in and which role in computing transition amplitudes, and these contributions are needed or not for the classical limit, and do they define a different theory or not? I think these are all open questions in front of us, as far as I can see.
If I may add something, a comment to the in favor of more complicated spin networks than just trivalent ones, I think that they appear, they emerge in loop quantum gravity because of the diffeomorphism covariance. We want to have, if we restricted ourselves to trivalent spin networks, then we couldn't apply all the diffeomorphisms. Whereas at least in this, there are those subtleties like piecewise analytic diffeomorphisms, etc. But at least in this class of piecewise analytic diffeomorphisms, it turns out that those spin networks we admit those general spin networks with higher valency than three with n valent spin networks, then actually we can apply all the diffeomorphisms. So for me, the diversity of those spin networks comes from diffeomorphism is a result of diffeomorphism covariance, which we are assuming, which we don't want to break as long as possible.
Yeah, I think there's a general agreement. I think the only statement is that you're, are reassuring, if anything, that we're not losing essential things if you restrict yourself to, I think Jurek meant four valent, not three valent, four valent spin. And I think that's all. And I agree that we have to see if, in fact, detailed calculations, if, in fact, we're losing some physics or not or something. But as a practical tool, it just says, well, we can just have a sigh of relief that more detailed work along simplicial complexes is not just marking up the wrong tree. And maybe, you know, it's capturing essential things. So it's just a reassurance at this stage, rather than any proof. So I think we're all saying very similar things.
Can I make one remark about this issue of the valency of the vertices? One reason why I'm happy about having the possibility of more than four valent vertices is that in loop quantum gravity, you need to have all possible valences in order to take the projective limit and really have graph independence of the theory. And sometimes I've thought vaguely about trying to do some sort of projective limit stuff to try to obtain some triangulation independence of spin forms. This is a very vague statement, but sometimes I've had the intuition that maybe this generalization to more than four valent vertices might aid in obtaining some sort of triangulation independence. Maybe that was too vague of a comment to make, but
more questions? Okay, since everyone seems comfortable, let's thank Jurek again.